Hello and welcome to A City of Champions, a seven-part podcast series diving into each individual game of the Cleveland Cavaliers 2016 finals run.
In game two, we're joined by Andy Liu and Sam Esfandiari from the Light Years podcast to discuss the Warriors' dominant win to take control of the series with a 2-0 lead.
We are set to go for game two. The last 6 years, the NBA Finals have been tied at one game apiece. Can the Cavs make it seven straight?
Cleveland trying to bounce back from just their third loss of these playoffs.
James passes. Thompson blocked by Vogan. His third already.
James hasn't scored yet.
Joel for four. Alley-oop to Thompson. Sends past Jefferson out the green. Tries another three. Puts it in. Draymond Green lighting it up. He's got 15. Thompson to the basket, and a foul! Another beautiful pass, and off the ball movement, and a chance for a three-point play.
This is one of those deflating stretches you spoke of, Mark.
Barbosa with the steal! The Brazilian blur! A 27-point game, timeout Cleveland!
Golden State, what an impressive performance. Shoot 54% from the field. And they'll take a 2-0 lead in these NBA Finals. Fifth straight win for them. They won the last three in the conference finals against Oklahoma City.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, part of the Blue Wire Network. I'm your host, Justin Rowan, and today we are discussing Game 2 of the 2016 NBA Finals. With me today is my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how's it going?
It's going well. I was thinking, since it's the second episode of the series, that we could go ahead and burn all the goodwill that we've earned and invite two people on that will piss off half our listener base.
Absolutely. We are setting a torch to this podcast series and bringing back. It only feels right to bring back the Light Years boys, considering how often we recorded back during this rivalry and even throughout this series. Sam Esfandiari and Andy Liu, how are you boys doing?
I can't believe you guys made me rewatch. I don't even care if the Warriors won this game. I can't believe I had to.
I have the opposite perspective as you. I'm actually really enjoying it. Carter's nice enough to send us all seven games. I haven't gone into all of them yet, but I don't know. It's just kind of fun. You realize how many small things you forgot over the course of the years, like little details, like how Sean Livingston did not miss a shot the entire series.
Terrified me. Absolutely terrified me. Like that's one of my takeaways. This was a better series. And Sam, I think you're going to find this. The individual games were better than I remembered. A lot of them were a lot closer. Even this game, it got out of hand and games one and two kind of both fell apart end of the third quarter and early into the fourth. But for the most part, this was kind of a feeling out process. And then the series got a whole lot more competitive once these teams kind of figured out how to play against one another.
Yeah, to me, after this game, I remember I was there. I remember to me, it felt like...
Shout out Carlos Santana.
You know, actually, this is one of my notes. Is it poor form to say, I don't support these Santana national anthems?
Why not?
I just want someone to... Like, it's such a, like... The national anthem to me is already kind of like an obligation. I don't need anyone to put a spin on it. Just, like, get it out of the way. Sing it well, sing it quick, and move on.
If we could bet on it, like in the Super Bowl, this one definitely went over a minute 55.
Oh, yeah. Interminable. And I kept thinking about how the drummer, who is wearing a very tight dress, she's not thrilled to be drumming in that outfit. Oh, that's his wife?
Right. Well, Sam would probably know better than I, but I think it is.
Yeah, we'll go with that. I have no clue.
He knows more. He knows a little bit more history. Well, hey, this game felt like to me like the same as a year before, where it just felt like the Warriors were too fast. They were playing at a different level than what the Cavs were. And it was just, I wrote the obituary after this one back when I was still writing. And this was with Stephen Clay not playing like that well. Yeah. And that to me was just like, well, shit, this one's over. Like, guys, this is done in five.
Well, the lead basically went from 7 to 20 when Steph picked up his fourth foul in the third. Like the bench was, I know we've all kind of had our laughs at the whole strength and numbers thing, but with how well, I mean, Iggy was still playing great at this point. His back wasn't bothering him as much as it did later in the series. Sean Livingston was just out of his mind. Leandro Barbosa played really well. And you know what? Even guys like Harrison Barnes were contributing in this game and giving a pretty good effort overall.
Yeah, this team was just... This is about as hopeless as it felt. They noted on the broadcast that LeBron had won 9 straight game twos after losing game ones. Because remember, the narrative for so long was feel out game. Game one's always a feel out game for LeBron. And then in game two, every series, including the 2016 finals, LeBron figured something out and made it work. And they just got absolutely wrecked. They couldn't score on this team at all. They had an 82 offensive rating in this game.
The beginning of the game, I guess we should start there, was kind of funny because I forgot how Cleveland used to always do the Kevin Love post-ups to start a game.
Yeah.
And he scores on the first one against Harrison Barnes. And then like 4 straight possessions, maybe not 4 straight, but like 4 out of the next 7 or 8 possessions were all Kevin Love post-ups where Andrew Bogut would come across with a weak side block.
James, bounce pass to Thompson, blocked by Bogut.
Love trying to post up Draymond Green, blocked again by Bogut. 4 rejections in less than 8 minutes.
This is the game where if you were wondering if Andrew Bogut getting hurt mattered, it's pretty obvious that it mattered because he completely cleaned the glass. But I think that was almost more of a symptom than the reality. I don't know what you guys think, but because the Cavs had just no clue how to attack this team. And as a result, their base defense, which had Bogut in the middle, was just feasting.
Yeah, and some people, because like the prevailing takeaway from the 2015 finals from the Warriors side was like Bogut was ineffective and they needed to go small. And for whatever reason, you can actually go back to the Christmas Day game from the 15-16 season. Bogut was also a monster there. So it might have been a mental thing in 2015, but he was just a lot more effective against the Cavs, particularly the Cavs trying to play that slow it down style early on in this series that was effective in the 15 series. The more they slowed it down, the more Bogut being 7-1 and, you know, kind of all NBA defensive caliber inside mattered.
Well, one of the big differences, too, was if you look at 2015, Mozgov was a big part of that series. And they played a lot of games with Mozgov and Tristan Thompson.
And he's bigger than Bogut.
Right. And he ended up, I think that was the year he had knee surgery after 2015 and just wasn't really the same player. Like, this game was actually one of the only ones that he played. And Ty actually, this was the attempt to go back to that lineup to start the fourth quarter. It was Mozgov and Tristan Thompson, and the lead went in about 30 seconds from 20 to 27, and this game was effectively over. And that was the end of Mozgov playing. So it's so funny to see that such a big part of the previous year series, where it was kind of benching Bogut at the end, the death lineup really kind of tearing apart that bigger, that jumbo Cavs lineup. That just wasn't the case with this series at all. And this series was so much different than the previous year where I think after this game, that's where the Cavs kind of realized, okay, we can try to muck up what the Warriors are doing offensively. We can be physical. We can try to keep them out of transition. But when we get the ball, we're going to have to push the pace. And that was something that the broadcast mentioned that Ty Lue was emphasizing coming into this game. But the Cavs were still not adjusting to the help defense that the Warriors had. And that was giving Kyrie and LeBron tons of trouble in this game.
Dude, I want to say that this is, and like Iggy is good in a lot of this series. Even when his back started hurting, he was still impressive. I have like 3 notes about him from this first quarter. He holds LeBron at 0 points in the quarter, plays very, very good on-ball defense.
James goes to Iguodala. Offensive foul. But another fine defensive play from the veteran. James drives, stripped. Boy, Iguodala just has fantastic hands defensively.
And I have a note here. He's the smartest tag-in defender I've ever seen. Like, there would be so many, like, so often when teams get switches and, teams try to coordinate that off-ball tag-in to get the more appropriate defender on, like normally it's pretty obvious when you concede the advantage for a second while you kind of navigate that switch off. Iggy just does it in a way that like they never ever opened up anything, but he gets back on James off ball. And it's just like, he was just so freaking good. His closeouts were insane. Like it just felt like the game changed when he checked in.
Yeah, he had the highest plus minus in the game. That was also something I noted. The Cavs actually started the game with a lead. I mean, it was 8-4, mm-hmm. but the Warriors kind of weren't getting anything going. And then they sub in Iguodala, and to me it was just putting another ball handler on the floor and probably the least turnover prone player on the Warriors.
One thing Steve Kerr loved from game one was that his team only turned it over 9 times.
Everyone else on the team loves to turn it over, but Iguodala is pretty good at actually not throwing it into the second row.
Pass inside. Fry got caught. Iguodala with a beautiful pass to Barnes.
That's when they started really getting out in transition, particularly against a Cleveland team that hadn't really felt them out. And that's when he started seeing all those, you know, trail threes from Steph or Clay or just, you know, the threat of that with two guys jumping at him and then just like an easy layup for Draymond.
Rewatching this game, was it weird to you to see these teams not all the way understand each other yet? Because that's been my earliest takeaway from games one and two is like, because like by game seven, these teams understood each other so thoroughly and so and knew everything the other was going to run and was junking up everything. And I felt like at least offensively, both teams were still trying to figure each other out at this point in the series. And like, I just have like 3 years of finals of game seven onward of like, no, they know what the other team's going to do.
I remember, well, we're not talking about game two anymore for me, but I remember game five. I wasn't there for game seven. But even in the first couple games, these guys looked nervous as hell.
Yeah,
that was still the case though in 2017 and 18, but kind of less so. I think just kind of you knew what was going to happen, but like here, it was just very much like the guy. You could see guys were rattled. Even Steph, even Clay, even LeBron, even Kyrie. I mean, Kyrie played like shit this game. Especially
this was his worst game of the finals.
Yeah, like you look at the numbers.
LeBron's
like
worst game.
Yeah, but Steve Kerr played 12 guys this game. He played 12 guys, and I think people forget that team, that Warriors team, because the last 3 years, the Warriors were pretty much like a different team. But those two
KD
years,
changed them so fundamentally, and I don't think I all the way realized it until I did this rewatch.
Yep, totally different. Like, totally different. It was close. And then the Warriors would go on these runs. They won this game by 30-plus, but it wasn't that close. Like, it wasn't that much of a blowout. Mm-hmm. It was relatively close kind of all the way through. And then the Warriors would go on these runs where like you would go from 15 to 30.
That's what happened in game one was the Cavs actually had a lead with a minute and a half to go in the third quarter. And the Warriors went on a 15-0 run. And a big part of that was Livingston and Barbosa in that game. And again, they went on a run this game with Steph on the bench, with Draymond and Clay just playing out of their minds.
Curry back out to Thompson. Open three. Bang! Thompson gets past Jefferson. Out to Green. Tries another three. Puts it in!
They missed one three-pointer in the third, by the way.
It was absurd. And the thing about the depth that they had was it wasn't like those guys were going out there and just initiating everything and dominating like a second unit. They were so good at complementing the big three that the Warriors had at that time and playing off that. Like Iggy could obviously initiate a lot of the offense, but he had good chemistry with Clay, and Draymond knew where all of those guys were going to go, and Livingston was such a cerebral player and finds those holes in the defense that it really doesn't give you an opportunity to let up at any point.
Yeah, I think that like kind of my biggest takeaway from this game is like it just continues to go back to this idea that the Warriors felt more unbeatable in these like they still had the unbeatable mystique in this series where like they felt inevitable. You know, in game one, it was Steph and Clay have objectively bad games and they still win because Livingston and Barbosa go off. In this game, the Cavs had to fly at Draymond Green on closeouts. And when you have to close out on Draymond, it's over.
Yeah, that was actually my number one take from this game was just how good Draymond was. Like,
oh, man.
When people say,
I forgot
Draymond
he
was
had
never,
this game.
Yeah, because everyone remembers game seven when he was hitting all those shots. But you forget they did it like two other games in the series too, with two being kind of the big one.
Well, he did it all postseason. Remember what he did against Portland too.
Yeah, it's not just the shot making, although in the third quarter, he hits a pull-up three-pointer contested.
Draymond Green for three. Puts it in! Draymond Green!
That's where I was like, okay, that's a little bit of BS. But it was also the athleticism. Like, when he would cut to the rim, he wasn't getting blocked. He was able to finish through traffic most of the time.
Yeah, he was in his backpack this game for sure.
Actually, that's actually one of my stray observations is that if Draymond shoots like he's got a backpack on, Delly just exists like he has a backpack on.
It was so clear in this game that one, Delly had no business in this series. Channing Frye had absolutely no business in this series. Like,
I actually have a question based on that, Justin.
Go ahead.
Who was less qualified to play against this Warriors team? Who is more helpless in this series? Poor Delly or poor Channing? I can't tell you how many notes I just have from this series and of just saying, oof, Delly, or oof, Channing.
Yeah, and at least Ty had the kind of stomach to bench those guys because they did not
play. They could not hang.
The last three games of this series, neither of them saw the floor.
I don't understand what got into Richard Jefferson.
Dude, he was so good in this game.
Backdoor play, Jefferson. Oh, beautiful play from Richard Jefferson. James the other way. Richard Jefferson draws the foul.
What was he on? Because I thought he was washed a couple years before he even played that. He was also decent the year after. Was he done?
He played well in 2017. Like, remember, he was a big part of that Christmas Day win. He dunked over KD and Clay. And he was good in the that finals as well. And actually, I really want to do a 2017 finals rewatch. I think that would be a lot of fun because I remember it's similar to this one where...
Shorter series.
Less episodes.
Yeah, yeah. The first two games kind of slipped away. But after that, each of those games kind of were very close until the end. And the Warriors had runs. And they... I mean, that Warriors team, like, do you guys get nostalgic when you look back at this one compared to the KD Warriors?
God, that's a good question.
The KD Warriors, even though they did have some series that went longer, it never really felt like they got out of second gear. It never felt like they were actually tested to the point where they had to execute at the level that this team kind of brought to the table.
To answer that question, no, I get nostalgic about 16-17 from... 2017 on, they stop being the Warriors or like the style of play that we associate with the team we're watching in the 2016 finals.
Yeah, KD stopped trying to fit in.
Basically. Yeah.
So that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah. 17 almost felt like a little bit of a hybrid. Like they still kind of had some of the same identity, but with KD in the mix. I almost wonder if the 2017 Cavs would have had a shot against the 2018 Warriors because at that point, it kind of the love affair that they had wore off.
The Rockets almost.
I want to say Tristan Thompson or someone said that during the 2018 finals that on the Cavs side, if we had our 17 team, I think we could beat these guys.
I agree. I mean, a big part of what happened in 2017 was also that Tristan wasn't healthy. But it's amazing. Like, I wish we got a little bit more of these teams, though. Like, I really, one of my big takeaways from this is just now that I'm removed from it, I really do enjoy the way that this Warriors team plays basketball. And it's so funny because we talked about how this Draymond performance is forgotten. There's a lot of performances that if the end result went a little bit differently, let's say if Curry scored on Kevin Love and the Warriors win the series, there's enough signature moments and great games from them where this series is looked at completely differently. And I think people don't give enough credit to both sides really on how well played of a series this was overall.
I think that for Warriors fans, that was Kyrie. That was how we felt about Kyrie. Like, I think from that moment on, I think you could even see from the way we started talking or tweeting, that was all Kyrie. It was very much like I was on the forefront of, like, the guy isn't very good. I honestly still feel like, dude, without those couple playoff games that he played 5, 6, 7, like, Kyrie's not, like, let's look at what he did in Boston. But here's the thing. He still played that great. He still hit one of the greatest shots of all time, right? Mm-hmm. And that's against, like, probably the greatest team of the last decade outside of the other Warriors team. Who knows? But that was how we felt about Kyrie. It was just like yeah, they won, but if the Cavs had lost, like, we probably wouldn't be talking about Kyrie at all. But he's the guy that changed their mind, where it was like, shit, like, that, those couple games were, man, if he played the year before, maybe the Warriors do lose. And, like, you can have those debates again, but Kyrie's that guy for me.
Where, if you want to talk about 2017 and things that are forgotten, Kyrie's performance is actually one of those things. Like,
he had
like a poor game one, but basically beyond that, it was, he got whatever he wanted.
Yeah, both of these series, right? Like, it was basically, he had one bad game. Like, game one in 2016, he was pretty good. Like, he got to the line a lot, and that was really rare for him in the series overall. But this was the one really bad game. But outside of that, like, you're talking about over 30 points per game, scoring very efficiently. He basically scored 30 every game after this one, 30 plus. And it's just so funny to see, looking at it now, and we've made this point a few times, but this is a totally different LeBron. Like, this was the first time where I felt the Warriors actually had the length needed to disrupt him from getting to the rim.
This is a great segue, Justin, because Van Gundy had an awesome game. I don't know if you guys listened to the call or were watching on mute. Van Gundy had an awesome game. He correctly, and I don't feel like people do this anymore, let's hold off our instinct to shit on the modern NBA for a second, but because I know that's what we're going to do after I say this, but Van Gundy said he completely rejects the idea that LeBron needs more help at the beginning of this game.
Mike, James needs more help, but he's got to play better too. So too does Irving. It's not just the supporting cast. Their best players have to play better.
It just feels like that's not something that's done anymore when stars like Giannis or someone struggle in the playoffs. Like, LeBron was not good enough in this game and early in this series, and he got better and better and figured it out. But, like, the fact is, he really didn't play particularly well early on in this series. And I think that people forget that. They almost, like, gave him, like continuation from the 2015 finals, where he was just, like, nearly died on the floor because he was doing so much. But, like, he was kind of ineffectual early on in the series. I mean, do you guys agree with that?
Very, very passive. Yeah.
Didn't know how to attack him.
That was my biggest takeaway watching this game. He looked like he was playing a regular season game in terms of just how aggressive he was being, only it was the finals. So I kind of forgot about this one. Like, I knew it was his worst game of the series, but watching the whole thing is completely different than looking at the box score and being like, oh, not a good LeBron game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just feel like, and like we've talked about it a lot, that his tactics really, the entire team's tactics really changed over the course of the series. Like, did you notice how little they attacked Steph on switches when that became their whole strategy?
I have that in my notes here. I'm trying to figure out how Steph picked up four fouls when the Cavs were
being reckless like he was the whole series.
Shot clock at 7. Jefferson trying to draw a foul, stripped on Curry, and that's going to be two fouls on Curry.
And Curry knows, not a smart play by him.
But beyond that, they weren't really going at him. Like, I couldn't remember which game. It was probably 3, but somewhere between 3 and 5, they switched their strategy to, I don't care who's open, we're just going to hunt Steph in a switch to wear him down.
It was basically 5. Like, they did a little bit of it in 4, but it was a later series adjustment than I recalled.
They didn't do any of it really in game 2. Like, at no point do you see LeBron. You can tell when he's looking for Steph in a switch. I mean, he'll outright direct people with his hand to, like, come set a screen for him. None of that in this game.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is that was when Steph spent all regular season that year kind of big shot hunting. He's a lot better at it now just because he's kind of older and he's done pretty much everything. But he spent a lot of that postseason and that series trying to one-up. There was no reason for him to switch on to LeBron is what I'm trying to say. Like, he could have easily just got back to his man, but there was just a part of him, like an ego part of him, where it's like, well, I'm going to show I can guard him. It's like, dude, like, why? Right? And that I also felt like with that K-Love moment, I know we're not talking about that game, but that was part of, you didn't need that pull-up three. You could have drove. And it was him being Steph. And that had worked all season long. And I think that got in the way a little bit. There was no reason for that behind the back. But that's Steph.
And it almost felt like he was overcompensating a little bit for being somewhat limited physically, right? Like he could still kind of explode somewhat, but he couldn't change directions as quickly. So I think he was gambling more with steals and reaching in.
Yes.
Like when we rewatch game six, like it was crazy. There was maybe one kind of debatable call towards the end, but he was like flat out begging to get some of those fouls with the gambles that he was making, and two of them were even intentional. It's so funny looking back on it now, especially when you see them early on. The one funny thing with this game, though, something Kerr didn't do in game six was when Steph picked up, I think it was his fourth foul. No, it was his third foul.
It was his third foul. He leaves him in.
He leaves him in for about 30 seconds to a minute, but I took note of that. I was like, oh, Kerr actually kept him in this time, when later in the series, he pulled Steph. And I think that there's a really good case to be made that they lost game six by pulling Steph too early.
I do. And trust me, I love blaming Steve Kerr. That's my thing. But it was also like, he was in a tough spot where it was Steph just was doing it, like overcompensating to me is the right way to put it. It was just, he's going out of way, it was his way to prove that he's not hurt or he's not hobbled and all this shit. And it's like, dude, let it go, man. Just right. But that's just, that's not him. There's nothing you can do there.
And a lot of this, like the most infamous thing with this Warriors season, the 15-16 one in the regular season, was the Draymond blow up at halftime with Kerr.
Sure. I'm not a fucking robot.
Yeah. Everyone thinks about that as like the central tension, but in many ways, it was the entire team when Kerr missed the first 40 games.
Oh,
with
we're going to talk
back
about this?
Injury.
Oh, we're going to. Okay.
The team was, I mean, Luke Walton gets credit, but they were uncoached. They did whatever they wanted. And when Kerr came back, he felt like they had all sorts of bad habits. One of them being how Steph essentially would try to pull a Kobe, where it's like, if anyone makes a shot, you know, I'm going to try to make a big shot in their face. And all that stuff that kind of gets away from
the way
what the Warriors want to be. But they were so good. It's really hard to coach someone and tell them they made a mistake when the mistake works and they win. And so it's kind of funny to see in the finals kind of all those habit things that Kerr would probably have pointed to, but it didn't matter because they just never lost as being the reasons that, you know, because it went down to the end of game seven. You can point to all the little margin things going differently and you should have won.
Well, right. That's the fun thing about such a close finish is, depending on what angle you want to take, you can blame it on basically anybody that's not named Draymond Green, right?
Yes, we can blame it on Draymond for leaving.
I guess so. I meant in that one game.
You very much can blame it on Draymond Green.
But it's so funny because, I mean, most of the time you guys very, very, very rarely break character. We get it a little bit in our group chats and stuff where we get more of your honest thoughts, but I always thought kind of blaming Kerr as much as Warriors fans did was a little bit of a meme, but there's so many moments where it really feels, rewatching the series, like, man, Ty like legitimately outcoached Kerr, and there was an absence of an adjustment from Kerr throughout the series that really looks like it cost them this series.
We'll be back soon with more from the Light Years Boys after this quick message from our sponsors.
With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think that there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline.ag, still has hundreds of sports, events, and games to wager on. Or let them bring Vegas to you with their online casino and blackjack. All are open 24 hours a day and all online, including their $750,000 poker series. And if you're into props and entertaining betting, you can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the weather. Visit their website today and join for a 100% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Be sure to use promo code BLUEWIRE. Bet online, your online wagering experts.
Isn't Kerr just like he's like a professor? He's such an ideologue. And he enjoys, like you can tell,
he gets a little bit of enjoyment when they screw up doing something he told them not to do.
Oh, totally. He views that as coaching. And he, you know, the fan perspective, everyone's like, dude, it's like game whatever of the finals. Let's save the big lessons for next season. Let's just worry about trying to win right here. But it's I think it's legitimately how he's wired, and you can't take all the good with Kerr without the bad, so to say. And this would be kind of the bad, where it's, you know, he wants to teach them in the most high pressure moments.
Do you think, you know what, I rewatching this game and getting into the fourth quarter when Mozgov comes out, after they go up 27, Lou immediately punts the game. And I just thought to myself, I don't think Steve Kerr would punt that game. I find it really interesting that Lou immediately calculated, we're not winning here. We're not going to burn a second of unneeded energy en route to this, and we're calling it right now. And I don't know if Kerr does the same thing.
Well, we know that Kerr doesn't do the same thing, because you look at 5 and 6, and there were multiple times where the Cavs go up basically 20. The Warriors push, they cut it down to single digits, and then the Cavs kind of respond a little bit and ultimately win those games. But especially once the Warriors started getting banged up, shorthanded, and also just kind of overcoming the mental hurdle of, we thought we had this series won, and we were kind of expending all our energy to close it out, and now, oh shit, there's more to come. I do wonder if they conceded one of those games and kind of rested everybody up, if it would have made a difference in this series. Well,
that Warriors team, they would have never had done that. That Warriors team, because they spent all season, like, they've won so many games losing by 10 with 5 minutes left, and they would just win.
Yeah.
So that was why.
This is another thing where it's so hard to, like, with the benefit of hindsight, you might be able to point at this, but, like, it's so hard to ask them to stop doing what they did all season, yeah, whether it was Steph being a little reckless or Kerr going too deep into his rotation and believing in the strength in numbers.
This is the ultimate armchair type stuff, right? Like, we're looking at it now, but I think Sam hit on this when he was talking about with Kerr. It's the same thing as with Draymond. Like, the reason he got suspended is the same reason he's great. Like, you take the good with the bad, and there's levels to this, right? Where that arrogance and the irreverence that the Warriors had, that no matter what, our best is better than anybody else's best. That's the reason they won 73 games, and it's part of the reason potentially here why they lost the series, right?
That, I mean, keep in mind here that Draymond didn't get suspended for his flagrant. He got suspended for so many flagrants.
Yeah. Exactly. I can't believe it's you that's reminding us of this.
keep in
you
mind.
You really have broken character.
No, it's actually, that's the irony of it. The foul that got him suspended was probably the least egregious foul of the entire playoffs. Like,
right,
of all his flagrants and technicals, that was the kind of like whatever, right? Like, LeBron stepped over him. He didn't even hit him. He just kind of, he tried to.
He flailed at him.
I want to get your thoughts on this. I know it didn't happen in this game, but obviously it's such a massive part of this series. I think obviously the Cavs did lobbying for Draymond to get suspended there. And it was brought up in the press conference. That was obvious. I know I personally didn't expect it to happen, because I was kind of like, well, if it didn't happen after he kicked Adams, it's not going to happen here. But I think this was the first instance that we really saw the social media pressure and the amount of people talking about it on Twitter and rewatching and rewinding that. And the way that Adam Silver has kind of made decisions based on what Twitter says, I almost wonder if this was more of a public pressure thing than it was kind of conceding to LeBron and the Cavs.
I don't, maybe if it was, it was reaction to them not giving in to the social media pressure over the Adams thing.
Yeah. No, that's what I mean. It all boiled together with this.
I think they definitely gave him, when they didn't suspend him for the Adams thing, which I still think was the right decision. Mm-hmm. But he definitely got the one
last
more
chance.
One yeah. more and you will be suspended. And he couldn't help himself.
He told the line all year, all postseason long. I remember my initial reaction when that happened wasn't like, well, that was a bullshit suspension. It was more like, like now he had a, it's like, fuck, dude, like, what are we doing here? But then it was also like, well, they're up 3-1. Steph just had an unreal game five, right? And it was like, or sorry, game four. Mm-hmm. And like, this thing's over anyway. So it was like, all right, we'll live with one loss maybe, and then we'll just move on from there. But yeah, he almost was like, dude, like, what are you doing? And LeBron for nutmegging him, or sorry, not nutmegging him, for putting his balls
stepping
on his
over,
head,
yeah.
Stepping over him. Like, I mean, that's a genius move. Like, fuck, you know, what are you going to do there?
That's basketball IQ right there, right?
didn't he get assessed for a technical? That's like, who cares? What was that? His second technical of the playoffs? Yeah. Like, there weren't even enough games for him to get a tech suspension.
the one that got him suspended is probably I think it was on Jeff Green in the Rockets series. That was just completely unnecessary. If he didn't have that,
wasn't it Michael Beasley?
It was Beasley.
It was Beasley.
He tackled him.
Yeah. At the end of the game, the game was over.
I mean, in a lot of ways, isn't Beasley Jeff Green?
Well, at least Jeff Green's still in the league.
Speaking of power forwards that aren't always effective, Kevin Love. I don't know if you.
Oh,
guys,
I thought you were
going to
save Harrison Barnes, but okay.
I mean, he could certainly be lumped in there. I hadn't remembered how good Kevin Love was in Game One of this series. Like, he was legitimately kind of tearing them up. I think he had like 15 and 12 or 18 and 12 through three quarters in Game One. Kind of had a cold fourth quarter, but everybody on the Cavs did. And him and Tristan were making an impact in this series. And there were a few things I didn't remember. One, I didn't remember that Love stayed in after he got concussed in this game.
Into the third quarter. He got hurt
When he started the second half, I gasped a little. I was like, yikes, this is not a good look. And then he pulled himself from the lineup because he wasn't feeling well. I don't know if you guys have ever tried to play with a concussion. I did it once. Mm. And it is not that is not something you want to be doing. But it's so funny to look at him pre and post concussion because he just wasn't the same player the rest of the series. And he was effective in 2017 and 2018 against the Warriors in arguably a tougher matchup.
I can also say the Warriors loved every time the Cavs went to
post him up.
Yeah, because they're like, okay, this is a possession. LeBron's not attacking us, or Kyrie is not attacking us. They felt very comfortable with him doing whatever he wanted in the post, even if it was one of those games where he would go 55% from those shots, which is a pretty good return.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was more just like, I think that because of the way that the series went for him from games 4 through 6, where he was like putting up like four lines of like 4 and 3, that I think people got to the point in their brains that they thought Kevin Love was like as unplayable as like a Channing Frye in this series. And he had utility in the right spots. Like, yeah, they were fine with him posting up, especially Clay or Iggy on switches. But nevertheless, like he did have just enough juice as a attacking closeouts and as a shooter that he was helping them on both ends of the floor. He's helping on the offensive boards. And yeah, he really was not the same pretty much the rest of the series. He scrapped it out in game 7, but like he just looked fundamentally different in game 1. Mm-hmm. And it was just really jarring to see that he stayed in the fucking game long as he did.
If we're going to talk about Kevin Love, one of the ways I know that Kerr may have regretted some of his strategic choices was in 2017 finals. Game 1 and 2 were, let's see how many pick and rolls we can run at Kevin Love. Which was something they really were not doing in 16 until, obviously, the famous play at the end
Sam
of the game.
Just fucking bringing this up. That's such a great point. No, I totally forgot about. That's such a good point because I totally forgot about because
they don't hunt guys. They don't.
This is Kerr's dogma. Like they don't believe in that.
I can't. I can't even say the fucking words because I'm so annoyed. But for Cavs fans, I think to know what Warriors fans were thinking about, as much as well as Steph has always played, Warriors fans always wanted more Steph on the ball, more Steph just doing anything, and less Steph. So I want to get your thoughts on how,
because we're always chasing
Steph,
the high of when he hits like 4 shots in a row.
Nothing better than chasing the high. But just versus on the ball or off the ball, what were you guys more scared of? What, like, or were they about the same? Like, you didn't care? They were both scary.
What was scary about the Warriors was Steph and Klay are more dangerous immediately after they give the ball
Curry
up.
Curry steps back, a three-pointer. That's good. Curry back out to Thompson. Open three. Bang! Four to shoot Curry from the 28-foot line. Oh-ho! Steph Curry from way downtown.
This team knew where everybody was going to be. They were so active. Like, they trusted one another, right? Like, if Steph gives the ball up to Livingston or Iggy, he knows that if I run my ass off and if I get to the other side of the court, I'm going to have a mostly open three, at least for Steph, because of the way that he can kind of elevate it and that quick release. It was just kind of how difficult it was to deal with them as a collective. Whereas later on, like especially with KD in the mix, there was more isolation. Like even Klay got involved in a lot of isolation in those mid-range shots. This team, just how well they functioned as a unit, it's so difficult to deal with. And we've talked about the difference that Bogut made defensively on the inside, but the difference between him and like JaVale McGee or any of the other guys that they've worked into the mix was he's a really underrated passer, and he knew where guys were going. And just that extra pass coming from the inside when it got to him, usually 2-3 passes later resulted in a wide open shot, and that wasn't available to them later in the series.
Here's what it is for me, is that I wrote in my notes for this game that this is the Warriors had the highest collective IQ I've ever seen. This year's Warriors, really the only player that you wouldn't describe as like super savvy was probably Barnes,
right?
And maybe Festus, but everyone else like had such a fundamental understanding of like what they needed to do. And I feel like that combined with the home run aspect of them in transition and off turnovers, that it almost felt like they had a lineup of like seven dudes who like hit 300 at bat at the plate. So, but just got singles and doubles. And then you had home run hitters that were there to get those guys home every single time. So there's always guys on base with the Warriors. Like, that's the thing. Like, you never got to chill out. When you overcommitted or worried too much about Steph, they would slip a screen for a wide open dunk that just felt like motherfucker, you can't allow that to happen when when you know Steph is going to go off, even when you guard him right. That's kind of my thing. Is it's not just one of the guys, just Steph or just Klay. And it's not just the strength of numbers. It was the confluence of all of them that made them feel so unbeatable.
I want to hear your analogy for the Warriors after this, because it is like, it's just different ways that they change. Maybe not for the better, but like they probably win the next three titles too, right? Like if Klay and KD don't get hurt, that's another title.
Just one of them didn't get hurt.
Yeah.
Like, right. I guess what it is this team, I think the reason that I hold them in higher regard is they were so much more than the sum of their parts.
Yeah.
And I always felt like the KD Warriors were just a little less than the sum of their parts.
They were underachievers, I think.
Like, I don't know.
Only year one. They proved their point year one with the 16-1 playoff run. And, you know, it basically took one of the greatest offenses of all time getting obscenely hot for them to not go 16-0.
25 free throws in the first quarter. Let's not forget. That's what we're doing.
We're still holding on to the most frustrating sequence, which was Korver missing a wide open three.
Right. Oh, I remember that.
That led to KD hitting the shot. I mean, if Korver hits that three, you lose that game in all likelihood, and there's a chance that it's 2-2. I think the Warriors take that series no matter what, because I think they still had another
game. They don't come out as flat in game four if they lose game three. But
right.
What I was going to say is I was so ready to kill Kerr, because if you remember in that game three, he left Steph and KD on the bench way longer than he should have in the fourth quarter of a playoff game. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards he gets to victory lap how they, those extra couple minutes on the bench gave him legs that LeBron and Kyrie didn't have at the end of game three.
Yeah.
And it kind of gets back to your point. Whoever wins gets to rewrite history, right?
Absolutely. And that's so much to do with this series. And it's so funny. were there any things when you guys were rewatching this that kind of took you back to that time? Because one of my observations, one of the things that's actually popped up a lot in this rewatch was I think it was game four that they were teasing the OJ documentary series that was right. About to
they were
launch.
Doing that. They were doing that in game two also, actually.
And the what other thing that I forgot before game two was series. That one thing that I forgot prior to game two is that Muhammad Ali had passed away. And I was like, oh yeah, I remember that ended up being a talking point as well, because there was some tie-in with LeBron, obviously, because whenever
there's always a tie-in with LeBron.
Yeah, whenever there's something historic, there's going to be a tie-in with LeBron. There was just so many kind of things that it really is funny that it's only 4 years ago. But I'm nostalgic for this type of a rivalry. I'm nostalgic for this type of basketball and just the content that was around at the time as well, surrounding it.
And tying it back to Carter's point about how the Warriors were more than their pieces, like more than the sum of their parts. It kind of ties to this rivalry. Another part that was really fun about it was kind of the clash of styles. I mean, Cleveland had two of the best isolation pick and roll players in the league, and they mismatch hunted. And it was a lot of, you know, kind of LeBron and Kyrie set the tone for how they're going to play. Whereas the Warriors, with the ball movement system and just everything being about movement and playing a complete different style. I mean, that's kind of what was so fun about the rivalry, because it was, it's like a boxing match where you get two fighters with distinctly different styles.
Yeah, especially as the series progressed and the Cavs did start kind of isolating and run. I found a lot of their offense was being run inside the three-point arc. Like, they were trying to make things go there and generating their isolation. And there's just, it was so bogged down, and the Warriors had so much length and their help defense was so good that it was disrupting it. And that was a big part of Kevin Love kind of being somewhat limited later in the series as well, was when the Cavs were really at their best, these versions, the 2016 and 2017 versions, it was a great isolation offense that got them good looks in creative ways to generate those isolations. But if they ever missed, Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love generating those second chance opportunities really helped level the playing field.
That's what I wanted. Because if there's one thing I don't think is talked about enough on this Cavs team, because really, whenever anybody talks about this Cavs team, it's about LeBron. But to me, Tristan Thompson, like, that was the, I remember thinking Tristan Thompson is not good, but,
or nothing damn, special.
But damn, like, Draymond Green had to work so hard, so hard to like battle Tristan Thompson, that it affected really like him and the rest of the team. And that's what, like, the toughness of this team, of this Cavs team, is underrated. Because you look at that, you look at JR, Jefferson, Kyrie playing the way he did after this shit show of a game. Like, I think those things are like, man, they turned that around, and I didn't expect it. I personally, right? Because, like, after just how great the Warriors were in the season before, like, you didn't expect those things. And to see them turn around, that was one of the things where it's like, you don't want to admit it. I definitely didn't want to admit it for a long time, but it's like, damn, that was a Tristan, I think, is the big one.
Tristan's a 16-game player, right? Like, right. He's not an 82-game player. He's definitely a 16-game player. I feel like the people that appreciate him most, like when you talk about fan bases that have a respect for how good he can be, it's basically Warriors, Hawks, Raptors, like whoever played him. Because even Austin, when it was a bigger center like Andre Drummond or Jonas Valanciunas, or when they played Steven Adams, like he was able to do that against the bigger guys. And I don't know if Andy's going to rewatch the rest of the series, but Sam, if as you rewatch the rest of the series, like his ability to switch on to wing players and Steph and Harrison Barnes and force misses, it was better than I remembered. Like his foot speed is really.
I was gonna say a lot of the, like, because the rim run and defending center became very in vogue in the mid-tens. Is that what we call the decade?
Yeah,
2010s, I think.
But
the mid-tens. The mid-off. A lot of
the dirty tens.
Yeah, a lot of the players who get praise for it, like Clint Capella, like Drummond, are simply not as good at it as Tristan Thompson was. Like, they might be 10%, 20% better on offense. Like, they have better hands. They get above the rim better than him. But they're just nowhere near as good defensively as he was at his peak.
Tristan Thompson. Thompson showing some ball handling. The runner won't go. Gets his own rebound. Back up and fouled. James hasn't scored yet. He's 0 for 4. Alley up to Thompson.
Oh, man. If he wasn't hurt for 2017, I know I keep going back to this, but that I think that would have helped push the Warriors a little bit more.
I was going to say, those guys can switch, but they can switch in the sense of they can hold their own against good perimeter players. Tristan could actually hold his own against like all-star caliber perimeter players, which is a big distinction.
I feel like that people thought that the Thunder had figured out how to attack this Warriors team when they went up 3-1. And then it just kind of proved, like, over time, like, we thought the answer to the Warriors over the course of that series, when they went up 3-1, was that you just got to go huge, because they were playing Ibaka, KD, Robertson, all these monster-sized players. And really what it mattered was you have to be big and be able to bully them, but you also have to be super duper agile and switchable. And
right.
Like, Ibaka couldn't hang, not really. Like, he could kind of, but like ultimately when Steph got hot, it was over. And TT in this series specifically was just like, I don't think there was a better big in the NBA for the in that year to do what his team needed
because
to do.
Length isn't enough. You have to actually be able to get up on the guy and not foul him, which, like, Ibaka, yes, he's got like a 7'5 wingspan, but he doesn't actually like get up on Steph the way that
he's all about
guards or wings.
He's about closing. Yeah,
exactly. Whereas Tristan Thompson could actually like get up into Steph the way that, you know, typically like wing defenders do. Like when you put like a Danny Green or a Kawhi on him, like how they can, because they're perimeter players. So I do think that's part of it. And the second part on Tristan is he is just really good on the glass in an effective way. It kind of highlights the point how not all rebounds are the same. Like, he'll never get more rebounds per game than Andre Drummond, but you can't tell me he's not more effective on the glass than Andre Drummond.
And there's so many times he doesn't get credited for an offensive rebound, but him battling for the board gets the other team to poke it out of bounds and gets you an extra possession.
Yep. Or just have to commit two bodies. That's the first thing they did in 2017. They put two bodies on Tristan.
Double team box out. I forgot about that.
It was Zaza and it was basically whoever the closest man was would double
Zaza
up on.
Zaza was kind of the perfect big for Tristan too, just to fucking rock. Hey, do you guys think, me and Sam have talked about this for years, do you guys think that OKC would have beaten that team?
No. They
weren't as good. I'm shocked you guys think that.
They weren't as good. They were worse than the Warriors. I'm very confident in that. And I think that LeBron still had something on KD at the time. And I think Russ just would have. Look at who's on this podcast. It's the four of us. We all don't respect Russ and his style. Like, I can't believe
he didn't. Not at that point in the playoffs.
But, yeah, and the Cavs just matched up. Like, every time they played OKC with KD, they would handle them. And once was without Kyrie.
Cooked Russ every time.
Yeah, and they beat him both times this year. I think they lost one without Kyrie by, like, 2 points. And then they beat OKC in OKC by a fair amount. And that was the Bedbugs game where Kyrie went out after 5 minutes and stopped playing.
Yeah, that was a game where they played the big ball lineup where LeBron was the point guard. It was like LeBron next to J.R. Smith. Like, they were huge.
Right. And Tristan did a really good job on Adams. Like, he was able to really limit what Russ is doing. And if, like, the way that Tristan was able to disrupt those Russ Adams pick and roll and get Russ to take bad shots versus getting to the rim. And then Kevin Love would just switch over to Adams and kind of take care of what they were doing on the board. The Cavs didn't have to compromise what they were doing to play the Thunder. Whereas against the Warriors, someone like Channing Frye, we're taking him out of the series. He can't play. The Cavs could have played the way that they played in the Eastern Conference. They could have done that against OKC. I think, looking back at it, and I know we've talked about this before, but I think for the rivalry, it's great that history unfolded the way that it did. But if both teams were healthy, I think the Cavs taken in 2015 and the Warriors taken in 2016. I just think that it,
yeah, I think most it unfolded.
Yeah, yeah. The way that it unfolded, though, from a narrative standpoint, the way that people were able to pick and choose what they wanted to take away from the series and the angles it gives you for jokes, it's what made this rivalry special. And there really isn't anything like it right now in the NBA.
I want to ask you guys about
this. Well, because it was organic. That's the thing.
It was organic, and it was so competitive. And I guess what I wanted to ask you guys was, do you feel like the rivalry – as we know it, the vicious, hateful, nuanced, layered rivalry, like, did it die after this? Did KD come and kill the rivalry? Because I kind of had this general take. It wasn't just the on-court stuff. It was just everything about the Warriors got less interesting to me.
KD killed the rivalry because we were the media as a whole, everybody as a whole, was unable to talk about it in any way that, like, mattered.
It wasn't interesting anymore.
I actually think Kyrie killed the rivalry in some ways too, because
Kyrie leaving really hurt.
Yeah, yeah. The minute Kyrie left, it was over, and then it became about Houston.
Well, I agree. I think if he would have stayed, things would have maybe got interesting. Especially, well, I guess if the minute the Warriors
take their foot off the pedal, they weren't. Like, there was an opening for Cleveland to make it a very competitive series.
Yeah, the unfortunate aspect of that is that Kyrie did need surgery in 2018, and Boston tried to limit that and push it to the postseason by playing him 20 or 30 minutes a game, and the Cavs wouldn't have had the luxury to rest him. That's one of the things David Griffin has kind of pointed to in the past. One of his regrets with this team was not getting Kyrie a backup point guard in 2017.
LeBron?
Well, true. That's 23's job. But no, like, Tristan didn't have a backup center basically after Mozgov, and that caused him to burn out and finally start getting hurt, and then he just wasn't as effective in 2017.
I mean, it's just hard to go to the finals this many years in a row. I mean,
yeah. And he was playing for Team Canada. Like, he was playing for Team Canada as well in those summers. Like, he's the guy loves to play basketball, but Kyrie wouldn't have been healthy for 2018 no matter what, and that kind of... If you would have stuck around, and if Indiana didn't veto the Kevin Love for Paul George trade after it had already been agreed upon, maybe that would have been kind of interesting.
Would have breathed some life into it in some way or another.
But I just think that these principal pieces needed to stay. Like, I just think the rivalry would have been fundamentally different. Like, there's so much scar tissue between these two teams after in that summer. It felt as vicious. Those 2 years felt as, like, important as basketball has felt in so long, and I just really missed that time. Like, I just said, like, I think the reason people still talk about this finals, and it's not just wistful Cavs fans because our team sucks now, it's still in the social conversation, and I think it's because it's the last time basketball felt really important.
Last time basketball was maybe competitive. But basketball was competitive.
Last year it was competitive, but it wasn't fun.
It's been competitive this
season. I don't think it felt really, really important. And in fairness, I think it's as important as basketball's ever felt because of all of these style contrasts and LeBron versus Steph, legacy.
The sheer volume of pressure on LeBron to win one in Cleveland. I mean, it's pressure he kind of put on himself, but still interesting. Yes, you have that, and then you have this team that comes out of nowhere playing a style that no one saw possible. So, I mean, it's a bunch of factors that were unscripted, so to say.
I have a question for you guys.
That LeBron factor was definitely scripted.
LeBron coming back to Cleveland, obviously there was like kind of a Nike script narrative to get him to be the kind of public good guy. It's the last kind of campaign with him that's really resonated with the public.
Very true.
And you also had the Nike versus Under Armour thing, right? Like, Steph was something that was so organic. And Under Armour was on the rise, and then he basically tanked that company by failing in this finals.
You know what I think?
Or he tanked it by taking KD.
Help me on this. Yeah, help me on this. I still think that a lot of the major moves are orchestrated by shoe companies because they're their primary employers for a lot of these stars. I think Nike Nike put KD in Golden State to help undermine Under Armour and stuff. And I think they put LeBron in LA. Like, I think that was a condition of his lifetime deal that he signed with Nike, that he had to go to the biggest market.
I think with KD for sure. I think that was one of the big
things. I think it's been written about that there were people. Well, it's been written in this way.
I don't know if it's been written
about. That they weren't unhappy. It's
been written about in very reputable forums, Andy.
Yeah, in DMs. It's been written about in DMs. But you're right.
They were not unhappy that he went to Golden State and you know, kind of dimmed Steph's light, so to say.
What I love about this rivalry, too, is Steph and LeBron just want the other one to like each other. Like, I think LeBron kind of gets some insecurity from Steph not kind of kissing the ring to some extent. And I think Steph gets annoyed that LeBron doesn't give him his roses for how good he is. And maybe some of that is kind of shoe related because obviously LeBron was... Yeah, I'd go ahead and end.
For Steph, it's everything. But the shoe thing, it kind of highlights it because... I mean, everyone's now knows the history of how like Nike messed up the pitch to Steph. Like, they're showing him the irony of it all is they were showing him a PowerPoint presentation and they forgot to take Kevin Durant's name out of it.
So, forgot about that, Sam. Holy shit. So, was that really what it was? Wow.
Yeah. That's like one of the factors that made him want to leave.
I know they screwed up, but man.
And, but yeah, I mean, Steph is so driven to be accepted by the quote-unquote elite.
Correct.
Like, because he just, I mean, it's all kind of narrative, like under-recruited player, went to a small school, all that sort of stuff.
Pro's son, so like,
yeah,
rich kid. I always thought that was a really interesting narrative that like seemed to really matter to like the players. Steph is this preppy, soft shooter that grew up as a player's son, and LeBron came from nothing. That was like a big thing that always got played up and always felt it was just another layer that like made people want to argue about these guys.
I think Carter, that was the big one, Carter, in 2016. That was the big one.
But it's funny because it's not like, you know, like Kyrie's a kind of upper middle class kid.
Yes.
Yeah, guys like Russ.
And Kobe was too. I mean, Kobe and Kyrie have the same kind of like
a difference between them. You know the difference between, them? Know the difference between them and Steph is?
They drive to the rim.
Yep.
I mean, I'm not gonna answer it the way you want me to, Andy.
they're willing to foul hunt.
Yeah. I think the difference is that Steph's actually a lot better than those two guys, Kyrie and Russ. He's actually the only one that was able to for other people to be like, oh, in 2015 and 16, oh shit, Steph is better than LeBron. And it was just those two seasons, right? And I think that was part of LeBron. It's like the same way Kobe was like, "Oh, y'all are saying LeBron is better than me? Like, fuck that! Like, I don't like that at all." So same thing, I think, with LeBron. And
when
then,
you're the king, you don't want anyone to be on your turf.
Well, I think ultimately, it's the real sign of respect, right? Is that he actually kind of the way that he responds to Steph, there was a sense of him feeling threatened by him. And you see it this year a little bit with like Zion. When he plays against Zion, there's another level because it's like, hey, everyone's calling you the next me, that you're going to be the next big thing. This is you're kind of getting a little bit of the Jordan thing where it's like, fuck no, like get off my lawn. I'm not going down without a fight.
He brings a different level out of LeBron than DeMar DeRozan does.
But you're right. And let's not, DeMar, come on. Random DeMar cheap shot. But he doesn't do that, I guess, with guys like Chris Paul or guys like even KD. Like LeBron hasn't done that with KD either. So I think where Steph looks at that and where he was just like, Steph doesn't care what you and I think, like someone like KD does. The problem is Steph cares about what like Oscar Robertson thinks, right? Mm-hmm. And when Oscar Robertson comes out of that season and says and kind of diminishes Steph's stuff, that's where Steph is like probably the first time or the one of the rare times where he's legitimately like, dude, I'm kind of pissed. Like, I wish these guys liked me more. Now I couldn't tell you why, but yeah, I think that came from LeBron too. And I think that trickles down to the way people started talking about Steph from that point on.
One thing I want to ask you guys about as we kind of get close to the end of this episode is the other thing that made this rivalry great is something that you guys are going to like because you're going to take credit for is arrogance season. The Warriors going villain. I think was the number one precipitator for this series feeling as important as it did, because it reframed
they took Draymond's
LeBron,
identity.
Yeah, it reframed LeBron as an underdog in the national narrative, which he hadn't gotten to be in a long time. Your thoughts?
It is actually. We were we had Miles Brown on our podcast.
Don't plug your podcast here.
Of course, I'm gonna plug it. Subscribe, Light Years.
Yeah, this is we're the two OG Blue Wire pods.
That is true.
You can promote your shit. Sorry,
but what I was Miles was he couldn't pinpoint to at what point he went, because he's not a Warriors or a Cavs fan, and he basically said like, I loved watching the Warriors. They were the most fun team I'd ever seen, or like I'd seen in like a decade. And then like somewhere before the finals, they really started rubbing me the wrong way, and I wanted the Cavs to win. And I feel like that was, I mean, he's just kind of summing up what felt like a national sentiment. And I still can't pinpoint to where, but I really do think it was right about that OKC game where Steph hit the 40-footer. From there on, they started becoming too much for people. People wanted to see them get humbled, basically.
Yeah, well, they were so much of what drove that Warriors team was fun and like celebrating. Mm-hmm. Like that, like them celebrating fueled the next crazy shot and the next celebration and so on and so forth. And like, because they were so unbeatable for so long, and they had Draymond reminding the you as every he was there to remind every fan base along the way that they were trash.
and he was great, and he was one of the top 10 players in the NBA at that time. Okay, so I think what I should have said this earlier. What happens with a lot of NBA players and teams is that they gotta go through some shit before you win the big one. Same with LeBron, same with MJ, right? The thing with Steph is he didn't really go through, like, you can say the ankle stuff and whatever, but like it happened.
But he
so
wasn't
quickly.
On that level when the ankle happened. He wasn't like, no one was like, Steph's the next guy.
So he won.
Which is what helped enable the team that they were able to build, because he was on that value contract. And even honestly, even Klay and Draymond, I think they both reached a different level this season. Like they were good in 2015 and they were putting it together, and
what if they lost?
Was great, but though, yeah, I honestly,
what if
I
they think, lost that season, that like that's what should quote unquote should happen. Like if they had lost that season and gotten that heartbreak and they won the next season, I don't think this team is hated. Like I don't think they're hated.
No, you're 100% right.
I don't think they win 73 games. I don't think they win 73 games,
right?
But they probably win the title, I think.
No, they go on a more they go closer to a linear path. Like they take a big step with Kerr, but they don't get to the title, and that allows Kerr to be like, okay, we need to improve X, Y, and Z to get there. Mm-hmm. Instead of what happened, which was they won the title, and then Kerr goes away, and then they think they're invincible, and then they play like they're invincible. In which case, like I don't know what a coach can do at that point. Like, how are you going to tell
not
a guy
fucking
like,
Festus Ezeleon?
Yeah, but how are you going to tell a guy like, okay, but that's a bad shot, and he turns to you and goes, yeah, but 49-4. Who cares?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, I absolutely, and it really does feel like this is the end of, and I agree. I think it was Andy that made this point earlier. I think this was the end of media knowing really how to talk about these teams. Like that was one of the big problems with KD, and it really stopped the conversation from being what changes does a team need to make internally to improve and to become a contender, to this star needs to leave, or this team needs to add this star. Like it all kind of becomes these quick fixes and the constant turnover that we're seeing now. I think this was the absolute end. And I think that's why things don't resonate as much with people these days. Who knows? Maybe after this detox, it will. But I think that's a big part of it.
The NBA this season certainly was on a path, I guess, sort of. But
we needed to see it in the playoffs to actually buy in, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there were also too many guys that were missing this season, too. Like, you needed the Nets and the Warriors in there this postseason.
Right. But if we got that Lakers-Clippers series, whichever way it went, it would have fueled the next season's narratives. Like, if the Clippers beat them, you would have seen insane pressure on the Lakers. If the Lakers beat them, it would have gone a different way. So,
yeah, this was supposed to be the palate cleanse season in a lot of ways.
It was supposed to be what 14-15 was in many ways, or what it ended up being.
It's so funny to look at it now, and I am disappointed that this season was derailed. I'm actually also a little disappointed, and this is kind of solidified after watching the series. I'm disappointed that we didn't get kind of Steph and Draymond this season and Clay at some point, because I think he could have came back if they were in the playoff hunt. I want to see those guys play again. I forgot until today that Andrew Wiggins is on that team. I don't know what to make of that. But
A fellow Canadian.
Especially now that the pressure is off.
He looked amazing in the 15 minutes he played next to Steph this season.
There you go. You can hang on to that. But it does make me nostalgic for that three together, especially removed from it, where you don't kind of have the pressure of trying to figure out how to beat those guys. It really is a beautiful brand of basketball. Do you guys kind of feel some nostalgia for I know we've talked about them together, but nostalgia for the rivalry or for the series?
I think you ask about nostalgia. I think Warriors fans, they might not want to think back yet, just because the run isn't over, or at least we don't think it is. But I think fans had nostalgia whenever they said Kevin Durant, pass the fucking ball and just run off a screen and you'll be wide open. I think that's
it feels fueled by nostalgia.
That is fueled by nostalgia. That is saying. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Or you can go deeper. It's sometimes your actions speak louder than your words. Every Warrior fan liked KD because they like winning and because you always
want to win. It was a transactional relationship.
Yeah. But you can't tell me the way the fan base reacted when KD got hurt and they beat Houston and then swept Portland didn't feel different.
The good old days are back, baby.
Yeah, there was a level of... they're chasing like first love versus, I don't know what you call it with KD. Well,
and still some validation, right? Like this team still kind of has a chip on their shoulder because people,
they never got a chance to fix what happened in 2016. Not really.
Yeah. And 2015 there, I mean, people will still point to the injuries and stuff. And then you had 2016 and then KD was the solution. I completely understand why the fan base would be, even if some of it is irrational. Like I think these guys have kind of proven what they need to prove. But hey, let's get it with these three again. Like let's finally win a title where people aren't pointing to some other thing. I completely understand that point of view.
Well, okay. I think 2 points. Number one, I think part of the KD stuff was also they never felt like KD was part of that, like loved them the same way, at least.
Right.
Fans.
It's back and forth. It's like he postures, he doesn't like you. So you posture, you don't like him. And then it goes back and forth for two years.
Turns out that was just KD as a person. That's KD, but it's, it's hard, right, to deal. And I think number two, the Warriors came out that season we're talking about right now where they won 73. I think they felt that way. They definitely felt like people think this is a fluke. We're going to show them. I actually think that now, if you ask them their true feelings, I think they're content with just what happened. I think they want to win again, like everyone else. But I think if you ask Steph, you ask Clay, you ask Draymond, and you say, like, do you guys feel like you need to win one with just you three? I think they'd say, we'd love to, but we don't need to. So I think they felt
I disagree. I disagree there. But I think if they do win another one, and I do think they have at least one more in them, it's going to take... Kerr always wanted them to be the Spurs. He wanted them to be, you know, different players, but like Tony, Manu, and Tim wanted that sort of thing. And I think they're actually at a place in their career where they probably see the game that way. Steph and Draymond have definitely kind of alluded to it. Like they will never chase 70 wins again. But they may be that team for the next 5 years who everyone writes off. And then around March goes on a run. And it's like, you know how like the Spurs did that for like what felt like a decade where you're like, they're not the same old Spurs. And then March 1st, you're like, okay, they're 18-2 in their last 20.
Yeah, LaMelo Ball is going to give them the point guard they always needed.
Exactly. But I think they're very comfortable reaching in. They definitely keep alluding to the fact that they don't care about the regular season anymore. So I think that's kind of what comes. I mean, we saw it with LeBron. You see it with any player who's been in the postseason enough times where they realize, like, right, I don't need to prove I can score 30 points or I can win an MVP. I need to pace myself and start peaking post All-Star break and then show everyone what I'm worth in the playoffs.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And boys, this has been a lot of fun. It's good kind of having this old group together. I think whoever actually looked past the names in the title and listened to the podcast, I think they would have enjoyed this experience. It's been a lot of fun. The nostalgia of this series has been, it's been great because I hadn't rewatched this series prior to this point. You guys, well, Andy.
Yeah, dude, he's an idiot.
Yeah, I'm an idiot.
I don't like rewatching games. Just I haven't watched 15, 18, or 19, or 15, 17, or 18, so I feel you on that. But just that's weird to not watch it. Yeah,
dude, this Warriors team freaked me out, man. It freaks me out. Like they're so good. I feel like if I'm watching it again, the result's gonna change.
Through all the kombucha and like bro tanks and wearing jerseys to go work out, Justin's a real weirdo. You know, like you might think he's just your garden variety bro. But you peel back one layer of that onion, and you have one of the strangest men I've ever
had. I mean, he does own a Steph jersey for Cavs listeners who've made it this far. You know,
and a Wiggins jersey. Maybe I'm a closet Warriors fan.
Well, that would be fun next season, hopefully.
The Isaac Okoro jersey.
Hey, yeah. you guys got a few minutes. Maybe you got to go, but I wanted to ask who your favorite draft players are.
Not on this podcast.
So everybody listening, if you want to hear the rest of this podcast, go to the Light Years feed. Why not? Let's do a little bit of cross promotion here. Blue Wire family. So big thanks to Sam and Andy. Carter, always a thanks to you and to all our listeners. Remember, if you want to support the podcast, the best way you can do so is by leaving a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, and resubscribe to help cook those books. And if you want to be part of the Chase Downs exclusive Discord chat, you can send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. Big shout out to everybody. This has been game two of the 2016 NBA Finals. Really appreciate you listening. And until next time, go Cavs.